Frisch serviert, der Steuerpodcast.
So, hello again. That's another episode of Frisch serviert or freshly served, as we would translate it into English, that we are doing in English because we have an English-speaking guest today. And I'm happy to welcome Itai Greenberg. Hi, Itai.
Hi.
Hi. That's perfect to have you. We are so happy to have you. Just a very brief introduction for the listeners that might not know you or are not familiar with your current position. You are a professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. You have been before Deputy Assistant Secretary for Multilateral Negotiations at the Office of Tax Policy, U.S. Department of the Treasury. And that already sort of indicates where our discussion might be going today. Our discussion, as always, I'm here with my dear friend, Arne. Hi, Arne.
Hey, Christian.
And we're really looking forward to have a conversation with you, Itai. But before we go into technical topics, maybe your last steps in your CV already indicate that it seems an interesting career from a German perspective, because in Germany, usually people, they hop on a career path and they stay with that career path. You have been Deputy Assistant Secretary, which is a very nice position with the Treasury. In Germany, people would never go away from there. But you went away and are now professor of law at Georgetown. And you might have had other positions in your life. So maybe just very briefly, some words about your CV and what you enjoyed most and why you are moving back and forth.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think I'm an extreme version of a U.S. tax career, but there are careers like this. I mean, I started my career as an associate at Skadden Arps in Washington, working on, you know, technical matters with the head of the international tax practice, and also on policy matters with what were then the three former assistant secretaries of the Treasury who were partners in that office. Right. So it was a great learning experience and made me think about policy, but also think about international tax planning. And then I left Skadden for a year to join this thing called the Bipartisan Task Force, the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform. That was a George W. Bush thing. And I, you know, helped work on a plan to reform the whole system that was never enacted. And then I went back to Skadden. And after a few more years of that, I decided to go to Treasury, and I took a civil service role. So I worked in the small group of 10 or so lawyers in charge of negotiating tax treaties and working with the IRS on tax regulations and representing the U.S. at the OECD and representing the administration before Congress. And I spent almost 5 years there and then decided I wanted to teach because I had always liked teaching and writing. And so I went to academia and spent 9 years there before, in effect, being involved in the transition of the Biden administration and being asked by Secretary Yellen to come back to Treasury, because I'd been there before and she wanted to give me a political appointment sitting on top of the Treasury's Office of International Tax Council, the office in which I'd worked as a civil servant almost 10 years before, to engage in multilateral negotiations, to engage in Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. And so there I was as the lead U.S. delegate for the two-pillar solution agreement and the G20 and the G7 and all of that. And of course, I mean, that was the most exhilarating thing I've ever done because, you know, every time Secretary Yellen left the country for a year and a half, I traveled with her. And that was terrific, right? Went to all the meetings, not just about international tax, but there was a small enough group that, you know, you went to the other meetings too. So that was great. And then after 2 years, I felt like we had done what we needed to do and that there were contributions that I wanted to make back in academia. And also, to be honest, I'd worked every hour of every day for 2 years and I was a little tired. So it was the end of my, you get these leaves in the U.S. from your academic jobs that last for 2 years. And it was the end of the leave. I needed to decide if I was going back or not. And so I decided to go back to academia. But I now also provide, consulting advice to a few firms on a selective basis. And I also serve as a senior advisor to this startup called Crux Climate, which is the leading emerging technology-enabled marketplace for the transferable credits that came out of the green part of the Inflation Reduction Act. So that's me.
That's great. That's great, Ida. And it's really, really fantastic to have you here on our little podcast. And just as a quick interest, you know, we're always very excited to have people. It's always nice to have, meet new people. But today I have to say I was really excited, Ida, that you actually joined, because we like to have very sharp minds here and who are also like nice on top. That's a great combination. And especially also because we can talk about also Pillar 2. And that's what we want to do as well to kick it off. And it's also great that you're here because you've been so close on the whole development from US side. And here in Germany, we talk a lot about Pillar 2 and we're asking ourselves, oh my God, these are complex rules and everyone is kind of feeling this overwhelming. And I think really everyone, companies, advisors, sometimes even maybe fiscal authorities. And I was just wondering, as you are here, and this is an international kind of development, of course, the whole project's international, and we have a lot of influence. And I feel some of those items, especially if it comes to the deferred taxes, and we might touch on this like coming after, come from the US. So from your perspective, is it just maybe we're just looking at more from a German perspective? You know, we have an exemption system. So a lot of our topics which happen abroad aren't really a topic because I mean, they're getting more of a topic, but we're exempting income. I think you guys already have for a longer time a credit system. Deferred taxes might be relevant as well. So maybe you can help us a little bit from your perspective. Do you see it also as complex or is it for you relatively straightforward? How would you see it from a US perspective, this whole suggestion of Pillar 2?
I mean, my view, coming from a U.S. tax training perspective, is that the guidance is still much more accessible and readable than our domestic regulations. And, you know, if you don't, and much shorter as well. And if you don't know why that is, I just encourage you to go, you know, read any regulation between Section 951 and 960 of the code, and you'll understand. I mean, it's a mess. On the other hand, I think that the complexities involving financial accounting and DTAs and DTLs are very challenging, in part because although how much is said about them in the guidance might not be, very many words, there's an assumption about knowledge of this entire other world that most of us did not have to address before, or only had to address in limited ways before. And so I do think it's fair to say that that element of what Pillar 2 does is quite complex.
But I sometimes wonder, we are talking about complexity. There's the complexity of the rule, and there's the complexity of complying with the rule. And for me, those can be two different areas, because I totally agree with you. Reading through US regs, that can drive you nuts. Yeah, especially it can drive me nuts. If I read Pillar 2, the model rules, actually I mostly understand what they're asking for, but I'm still complying with them. So practically being able to follow those rules, that is the complexity, which I believe is very, very challenging. And that's especially in the adjustments to cover taxes, and there again in the area of deferred taxes.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, all I can say about that is that in that space, it was the United States who, for the longest, continued to insist that we would all be better off with a carryover system. And I continue to believe that we all would have had an easier time both understanding and complying with a carryover system. Some people who followed the Pillar 2 process know, the issue of DTA, DTL versus carryovers was debated for a very, very long time. And the business community pushed very strongly for a DTA DTL system and slowly picked off government after government after government, convincing them that DTAs and DTLs would be better than carryovers. It then became clear that governments were not, however, comfortable with DTAs, DTLs, except for with various adjustments. Nevertheless, the business community, even though at least some people in BAC knew, continued to push for DTAs and DTLs. And my personal experience was, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I had this role where, you know, I had to deal with everything from the most senior kind of political requests from the White House and the Secretary of Treasury and the finance ministers down to technical issues. And we needed to reach agreement before a G7, G20 meeting, and we were the last country left. And it was time to get to a deal. And that's when we dropped the request for carryovers. And I think we were right, but we were the last one standing and we lost. And so now we have this particular source of complexity, which I, you know, regret, but don't know what we do about.
Yeah, so actually that's quite interesting, Christian. I think we need to also invite someone from BIAC on the next you know, podcast to basically look at, to talk about this a bit more detail. But actually, Ida, also thinking about complexity and coming back, how this can be applied and where we have, you know, sometimes challenges is there is an attempt to take out the complexity, and that's, I'm talking about the safe harbor rules, especially the country by country safe harbor rules, which is really an attempt to make this more easy. I think everyone was quite relieved. Or is basically basing the assumption that this becomes manageable, also using this safe harbor. And I also thought that's going to help to a certain extent, or maybe even a lot. But now, actually, end of last year in December, we had the latest guidance with some kind of clarification when the CBSR rules have to be adjusted, basically, on what's being called, I believe, hybrid financing. If you look through this, if I think about hybrid financing, I think you have a deduction in one country and non-taxation in another one. But these rules are much broader, you know, if I understand it correctly, in certain circumstances, even if you have losses in one country, basically, which are offset and they're not, you have no DTA book for it, that could qualify as a hybrid finance. So suddenly I might be ending up to look again through different kind of transactions and trying to identify to what extent they are covered, which I believe then kind of, yeah, makes it, I don't know, harder to apply those rules. And I think the simplification goes away. So what's your view? How can we balance this? I mean, obviously this is in order to prevent any kind of, you know, planning, I suppose, around this. How do we balance this simplification against trying to prevent avoidance? This seems to be really a topic which is hard to balance, but I don't know whether you have any views on that.
I mean, what I guess, you know, so let me first just level set to listeners. So I speak with some distance from the guidance package that Arne is talking about, because it's a December 2023 set of guidance that Arne is referring to. And the last package that I cleared on and spoke in favor of as the lead U.S. delegate for the inclusive framework was the February 2023 guidance package. So let's be clear about where I sit. I'm discussing this as an observer, not really as someone who was engaged in the process of reaching this set of rules. OK, I think it's important to say that for the audience because they wouldn't know. My own view is that the complexities, you know, being introduced in the December 2023 CBCR safe harbor, you know, they make sense if and only if what is happening is that we're evolving towards a permanent safe harbor, right? In other words, more complexity. I understand why governments want more complexity if the CBCR safe harbor is eventually supposed to be permanent. As a temporary measure, additional complexity does not make any sense at all, right? I mean, it's crazy it's crazy for a temporary rule, right? And you know, I mean, you can say that there's the hybrid stuff, but there's also, like, you know, what constitutes a qualified financial statement for purposes of the transitional CBCR? What's the simplified ETR calculation, right? Like, all of this stuff is excessive for a temporary safe harbor. But if it's an attempt to revisit the architecture of the rules via a safe harbor to get to a permanent rule that balances, you know, concerns about avoidance and abuse with, like, a simpler way of administering the system, then maybe there is something here, right? And I actually believe that's secretly what is happening, right? So I tend to think that the working party, the working party is toying with what would have to be done to be accurate enough. In some sense, that's a win of the business community. That's not a loss, but only if they go the next step and actually accept the idea that we're trying to understand, you know, how to make this easier on a permanent basis, not just about 2 years where really, what are we doing? That's my view.
I mean, this is a little bit driven by the hope, the desire, the wish that there is always good reasoning behind developments, right? Do you really believe that there is a strong interest in simplification? And sometimes I wonder if at an inclusive framework level, that is a core topic of the delegates.
I think that there is not an ability to answer that question with respect to all delegates or all governments. Yeah. I think it is fair to say that there are some delegates and some governments who believe that is important. I also think that, you know, the more technically savvy the delegate, the more they tend to understand that there's a point where it's too hard or too crazy or just not that operable. I mean, if you don't, it's a very complicated balance, and there are different levels of sophistication in these working parties. That's just the honest truth, you know, and different and different natural perspectives of governments, to be frank.
I mean, that's absolutely true. And who would know that better than you? The inclusive framework is not the OECD. I mean, it's 142 countries. So the diversity of the delegates, the diversity of political systems, the diversity of perspectives is certainly much, much, much wider than within the OECD member countries. Absolutely.
But even the OECD member countries, I mean, you have differing kind of legal and cultural traditions about these things. You know, one could easily spend, I will not do it, but one could describe the difference between the way that German government tax technicians and British government tax technicians think about a tax problem, and one could spend a full podcast on that, right? Very easy.
That might be a busy one.
Absolutely. That's a good idea. It's a good idea, Ida. I will actually note that. And actually, coming back to that, I mean, all these different rules, I just want to touch on one item which I think is specifically interesting and underrepresented. I'm sitting today here actually as a background in Düsseldorf because I just came out from a meeting from the German Chartered Institute of Accountants, which is the EDV for the German folks out there, where I'm actually heading the tax board, so to speak. And we had a discussion around also international accounting standards and the Pillar 2 rules. And I mean, if you think about it, where this all comes from, I think the idea was we want to have something which is there, which is available, which seems to be, you know, whatever is being used to consolidate your accounts, IFRS, US GAAP, you name it, basically. So the idea is, again, to simplify, which in general is a positive idea, I think, you know. But then if you think about where we are right now, I'm just wondering whether this was really the best decision. If you just reflect on that, in the end, what is there are consolidated accounts. And now we all understand, at least in Germany, it's a big topic, that these accounts cannot be used because these accounts need to be actually on a standalone basis, because normally those consolidated accounts don't have intra-group transactions. By the way, I hear sometimes if I talk to people from other countries, maybe the discussion is not so strong, but in Germany it's a very, very present discussion because we take everything too granular, I guess. So we are now sitting here basically looking at the accounts and saying, like, we actually have to reinvent them and do them on a standalone basis, which is not the case. And then on top, it needs to be, of course, on IFRS and US GAAP accounts, and also for any kind of tax return for the QDMTT. So if you have a German subsidiary, you know, from a US parent, you actually have to prepare standalone accounts on a US GAAP basis. And I don't know US GAAP rules well enough anymore, I have to admit, in order to really be able to advise it. And if I'm also having another client who is sitting anywhere else, let's say in France, it's IFRS. If it's in China, it's Chinese GAAP. So I actually need to all these rules. And then the other thing is what I'm just want to share, if you look into this account, sometimes the consequences are very different what we are used to. So I'm just looking right now into transactions where you basically have a forfeiture of loans, basically, and suddenly income is generated under these kind of set of rules, which then might lead to low taxation, because you have income, if it's cross-border, sitting in one set of the accounts, and under your local rules is tax neutral, because this is just a refinancing. So I guess where I'm getting to with this way too long question or introduction is, was this really a good way to basically use these accounts? And is this way of simplifying it actually turned out to the exact opposite?
Well, I mean, I think it is important. Given the nature of the question, I think it is important to back up to the starting point for a second, right? Which is, okay, once you have a decision to have a global minimum tax, one has to ask, well, on what base, right? And there is no globally agreed income tax accounting base, right? These are obvious things to say, right? Moreover, we all know that Luxembourg has a 25% tax rate on a tax base that's narrower than my finger, for example, right? So, you know, there was some need to kind of come to some sort of common base, okay? So it is true that there was a convergence process between US GAAP and IFRS that went on for 25 years, and that was the closest thing we had to a common base. Now then, the fair criticism is to say, okay, I understand how you got there. Now let's ask, how much of the rules of financial accounting do we each need to understand in order to administer this thing? And how can we make it so that we utilize that commonality as a starting point, but don't overutilize it? For me, that gets back to the carryover point. But anyway.
Just in defense of Luxembourg, because people might not be able to see Itai, he has very big hands, right? So... that I believe that needed to be said, right? But maybe before we get to some of the other obvious questions, which especially from a non-US perspective, also from a US perspective, are interesting. So what's the future of the US position on Pillar 2? Looking back at the process itself, from your insights, what was the biggest achievement of the whole negotiation process around the P2 model rules, but also what was maybe the biggest failure?
I mean, I think that the biggest achievement is agreement. I think that we actually changed the tax world in a way that, at least in the United States, no one thought was possible even 3 or 4 years earlier. I do not believe that when the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 blueprint was agreed, I sadly think that the U.S. multinational community didn't really think it would ever come to fruition, right? I think that we could tell a very interesting story about how I got my job, but my getting my job involved briefing not just Secretary of the Treasury, but five people who are currently cabinet secretaries of the president. That's how this title came to exist, and the idea of a whole government commitment to the project came to exist. But I've been told afterwards that people said, well, Secretary Yellen believed in it, but we didn't think it was going to happen, but we signed off, right? So, you know, I mean, that's the truth, right? There are a lot of people who did not believe it could be done, and it was done. And it has changed. It is not perfect, but it is a fundamental step towards leveling the corporate tax playing field, providing some degree of uniformity, stopping the race to the bottom on corporate tax rates, addressing tax competition in a reasonable way without saying that it's gone completely. Like, I think there's a lot to that. Now, I also, quite frankly, think that those are all tax achievements. And I think on an international tax basis, that's an incredible achievement. But I also think that there was a failure, to be honest. And it's that for me, it was always the case that the corporate international tax achievement was the secondary goal. And the primary goal was we were coming out of the Trump years where, as you will recall and may be concerned about for the future, there were tremendous tax and trade tensions between the U.S. and our historic, you know, liberal democracy, liberal in the English sense, democratic country allies. And there was an attempt to use the Pillar One and Pillar Two process to restore, you know, multilateral international economic cooperation with U.S. leadership. And I think there was some degree of success there, but frankly, for there to be full success, the U.S. needed to then kind of go right ahead and pass a bill to come into compliance with Pillar Two without having the rest of the world try to drag us in. And the truth is that I believe the U.S. will comply, but I believe that the U.S. will comply on a very different path in which we're dragged in. And I think the consequence of that is not different for corporate international tax purposes, but I do think it is meaningfully different in terms of trying to show a roadmap to international economic multilateralism that stabilizes the liberal international or economic order or the parts of it that we all thought were good, or, well, listeners of this podcast probably thought were good for the last 50 years. The truth is that, like, a very large part of the society, both in the country that I live in and in Germany, no longer believes that, okay? But there are probably many listeners of this podcast who generally thought, well, you know, globalization is not a bad word, right? And I'm not sure that the way that this has gone has been successful with respect to that broader objective. And I view that as the thing that I am sad about.
Right. And Ida, actually, you're spot on, because that's what really one of our last questions. I mean, I think you agree that multilateral kind of agreement on the reform is something we always were asking for all these years. Now, I think you very nicely described the current status. You said the US might be dragged into the whole process, and we will see what will happen. But it was, I think, Pascal Saint-Amand who was on this podcast some weeks and months ago. We talked about the current status. And I think at that point in time, and I would still think that's my current observation, is it's really two different developments. We have Europe basically going, implementing those rules more. More, we have now our tax code, our Mindeststeuergesetz, since a few months, basically. Other European countries will also implement it. The US is still, you know, so far not pushing ahead. Let's see what they will be dragged onto. But so far, it looks also there's a development of two different worlds basically arising. And I think with Pascal, I think we even said it's almost like two trains, you know, driving on towards each other and tension arising out of it. And I think Pascal also agreed towards that. So Ida, your view, do you see, I mean, I think you kind of give the answer, or you're hoping you're going to be dragged in, but what other kind of way how to solve this if do you see in order to get to a status where you basically have stability again, also for the companies obviously all involved, because they're in the middle of it, you know? So
yeah, no, I mean look, I think for German listeners, it's probably important to say, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is the 2017 tax cuts in the United States, expire at the end of 2025. And unless Congress acts, that means almost two-thirds of U.S. individual taxpayers will have their taxes go up, let alone the GILTI rate going up and the FDII rate going up. The point is it is the fact is that Congress won't let two-thirds of U.S. taxpayers pay more taxes without doing something about it. So we're going to have a big bill. And the problem is it's very hard to predict what that big bill will do, because we have an election between now and then. There's not going to be a bill this year, and the bill will come next year. And it just all depends on the U.S. election in November 2024. I do believe that, you know, the fact is that you need $3 to $4 trillion to extend all of the 2017 tax cuts, which means you have to find revenue somewhere. I do believe that it's likely that the corporate tax rate will go up regardless of what else happens in the U.S., the domestic rate. And as a result, I think there are fewer U.S. M&Es that will end up having UTPR risk on the domestic base than complain about that risk now. But of course, you know, that's because it turns out that it's harder to get below a 15% effective rate on like a 25% statutory rate than on a 21% statutory rate, right? Like, big surprise. And so I think there will be resolution. I think that if you see Democratic control, you'll get a QDMTT. I hope that we'll get guilty country by country, but I'm less afraid of it than other people are. I also think, like, yeah, I think there are various mechanisms that will resolve the tension effectively.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess speaking about the future U.S. tax plans, that's also another podcast. We can't go there. I just read that in Biden's vision for the 2025 budget, the corporate tax rate would go up from 21 to 28. But yeah, let's a totally different discussion. Before we come to an end, I'd like to go into one thing that you mentioned at the very beginning, because in our podcast, we from time to time happen to focus on digital developments. And you mentioned a trading platform. The name was Crocs Climate, if I noted it down correctly. What's that all about?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. I really appreciate it. So I left, you know, I left the government and, you know, in the nature of having a U.S. tax career, I decided to, like, you know, invest in and join a startup, too. And the reason that this is interesting is, look, I mean, clean energy developments in the United States are booming in light of the Inflation Reduction Act. And the thing is, that act, right, I mean, it's the single biggest investment in a transition to a cleaner economy in the history of the world. It is making hundreds of billions of dollars of tax credits available to companies building facilities or producing clean power and materials. But in order to make sustainable finance more efficient and move, as quickly as needed, the act decided not to do refundable credits, but to make transferable credits. That means that developers that might not have positive tax liability can, in effect, sell the credits that they've created, right? The difficulty is there's so many of them, right, that to make the marketplace work, it must be really efficient. It cannot just be the largest banks intermediating multi-billion dollar transactions, because there are tons of small developers doing small projects that produce smaller amounts of credit, right? $10 million credit projects, $50 million, $100 million, things big banks don't really want to deal with. And so we needed a digital platform, a digital solution to make this policy decision work, okay? Crux Climate is the emerging most important marketplace for transferable tax credits. It helps bring in more buyers, creates a place for sellers of smaller amounts of credits, offers financial products associated with that stuff, has purpose-built software to work well with all of this, is led by a technology team and an energy team, with the tax people being kind of like the third leg, not the first leg. And our network and tools basically streamline the transactions and provide access to this emerging marketplace and try to reduce risk and increase trust. And it's really challenging and hard because it's a multidisciplinary problem. It requires diverse perspectives. And so, you know, the core of the team is people who built a multi-sided marketplace in another area first. And then we added on all the other people, the energy people, the tax people. We brought in the finance people from the prior startup. And we've raised over $25 million in two rounds from some of the United States' leading venture capital firms. And there's now over $8 billion in credits currently available for purchase through the marketplace. And I'm tremendously satisfied about that, because it's not the transactions that the big banks would have intermediated. It's other transactions. And $1,500 million, like, the big banks don't get out of bed for that, but it's real money. We can help companies meet their sustainability goals while managing their tax liability through this platform. And I'm very proud of that. And frankly, I'm happy to talk to any interested listener more about that project. And I'll do it now because I'm supposed to. Why not? Or go to cruxclimate.com to learn more.
That's so great. I feel, honestly, we have to stop talking to you now, because I'm starting to feel depressed. I'm staying with my company, Siemens, for now 22 years. I've never been to Treasury. I've never been to I don't know where. I'm not an entrepreneur. At least we have the podcast on, right?
That's true. I agree. Same for me. I'm also 22 years with PwC. Never done anything, but we have the podcast at least. So, no, actually, yeah, that's great. And actually, it was nice to hear that from you. And we hear your entrepreneurial spirit. And yeah, and I think it was also a fantastic podcast. Thank you so much for joining. Let's see. Maybe we have you next time up already when your startup became into a big organization. Then we talk about the consequence of Pillar 2 for this company. We will never know. So we'll see.
That would be terrific. We could also just talk in 2025 about what's going to happen in the U.S. once we see an election.
Absolutely. No, great. Ida, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun and very interesting. No,
I really love being on the podcast. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
Really.
It was great.
Take care. Take care, Ida. See you
Bye.
Soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
'Frisch serviert', der Steuerpodcast, powered by CH Beck.